Well, with many thanks to Pastor Mark Burkholz and Pastor Ed Schupe, two of our mission counselors from our Wisconsin Synod who interact with probably more brothers in the parish ministry than almost anybody in our synod. And thank you for your time today as you help us iron sharpen iron when it comes to managing ourselves and God's gift of time. So the first thing I'd like to ask you is, what do you think are some of the most critical mistakes we make as pastors as we seek to manage God's gift of time? I don't know who wants to go first, but Mark, you're going in alphabetical order.
Okay, we'll go alphabetical. One that comes to mind, it would be the inability to say no when I'm asked to do something that doesn't line up with what I've identified as priorities in my particular mission setting. And I don't know if it's a bashfulness, if a compulsion, we must always say yes. I don't know why, perhaps it's different for every guy. But at some point we have to keep in mind what our priorities were, either prescribed by the church council or among yourself. And some things you simply need to say no to. If you'd like a second one, I think it's a management of time where I may hand things over to laity. I train them how to do things, but then I spend time micromanaging or overseeing or hovering, isn't that the term now?
Mm-hmm.
Hovering mom. That there are guys who I think just need to learn to trust. It may not look exactly like you wanted it to. They might do it differently. You simply need to trust your lay people or your secretary or your vicar. Go ahead and do it.
Don't constantly be taking it back.
That'd yeah. Don't waste
hovering
time.
Hovering over their shoulder. Huh?
Yep. That would be it.
All right.
Good.
Ed, how about you? You can respond to anything even okay. Mark mentioned too.
Okay. Well, I agree with everything that Mark said. Just to add some other things. The underestimation of how long it takes you to complete a task. And this can be any type of task. For example, I spoke with a pastor yesterday about shut-in visits. And I said, well, how long do you plan your shut-in visit to go? And he said, 30 minutes. I said, how long do they usually take? He said, an hour. Okay. And I said, do you count drive time in there? He said, no, then I'm always rushing. And the thing is that what he's allowing an hour for, he probably should be allowing about 2 to 2.5 hours for.
So he has a sense of being behind instantly.
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. And that's where the stress comes, nervous driving and attentive driving and all of that, and just makes it a really difficult thing. And then as that progresses through the day, you're always behind. I think the other thing is getting hung up on to-do lists. On a daily to-do list that we have to get all of this stuff done this day. And of course we seldom ever do because we don't plan for flexibility. What if I do get that phone call? Well, why don't you plug it in there? For example, going back to the shut-in visit,
mm-hmm.
Okay, program 2 hours for it, but allow a half hour on each side of it. And then you've got that flexibility that can say, oh yeah, I can speak to you, but only for 30 minutes. And people usually don't mind that as long as you know, they know at the get-go, and like I say, that always eliminates the small talk, gets to the heart of the matter,
mm-hmm.
when I've only got 30 minutes to give you. And so, that when they don't plan the flexibility, and they've got themselves scheduled tight, I've seen guys with a to-do list, and I said, this would probably work well for a week. And they said, it's for
a day.
So, okay, mm-hmm. Now they're 5 items behind. So they start the next day already in the hole. So I can never get caught up. Granted, I don't think there's any day that I ever stepped out of my office or Mark's or yours where we said, I got it all done today.
There's nothing left to do.
But at the same time, I think it demoralizes them. And they feel tremendously overwhelmed. And they're always playing catch up, which isn't a lot of fun.
So every day becomes a bad day.
Bad day.
Well, I didn't get done today, but again.
And again, I guess I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I think that's the difference between the daytimer organization and Stephen Covey. Daytimer was what they call the third dimension of time management. That was the to-do list and then assigning priorities.
ABC, 1, 2, 3.
Right. And Covey said, we're going to base it on roles and relationships. And we're going to set it up not for a day, but for a week. I think that's just fits right into the pastoral thing. When I talked with Dr. Covey, I said to him, I said, but can we have a calendar that starts with Monday and not Sunday? Because for us, the crescendo is Sunday. Sunday is really the end of our week. It's not the start of our week.
Good point. Now that you've heard each other a little bit back and forth, anything else that you'd add or that fits in with what you've heard as far as another mistake that we make too easily as we manage ourselves in time? Anything else that's still out there that you'd like to address that you see a lot of?
I can't think of anything because mine would tend to be autobiographical. Because realistically, we go in and work with guys and we'll look at their schedules and stuff like that, but we don't stick around to walk through over the week. So I just have a hard time identifying what he may be doing wrong, except if he would tell me that.
All right. Yeah, we don't want to turn this into personal confessional.
Yeah,
this
right.
This is an interview. Yeah. Well, how about
the one thing, just to maybe piggyback on what Mark was saying about trusting your people.
Mm-hmm.
I got a copy of Life's Little Instruction Booklet from one of my members on a calendar thing, and there was one that stayed on my bulletin board till it turned yellow. And it said, when you ask someone else to do something, let them do it their way. And I wonder if our pastors sometimes feel that I'm the only one that can do it this well.
Mm-hmm.
For example, some pastors are still doing their bulletins, the formatting them and everything else. Because
it has to be my way, huh? That's
yeah,
what I want it.
Huh? Right. And so I think there too is the, I had a course once and it was called The Art of Delegation, and the professor started off by saying, this is not a science. This is an art. But when you delegate not only responsibility, but authority. And that's where I think you have a big time release, because all of a sudden, it's your project, you do it, but as Mark said, the joke I like to use is, Mark, this is totally yours to do. Do it any way you want to do it. Before you do anything, check with me.
Each step along the way.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I want to control how it comes up.
Right.
My reputation's at stake. I think Colby talks about the difference between gopher delegation and stewardship delegation.
Right.
I'm not sure if that's his right second word, but
yeah.
The gopher where I'm going to tell you every step along the way, so it's still my task. I'm worried about it at each point.
Right.
Well, let's switch to the positive side then. Tips, insights, things that for you or that you've seen for others that work well. That can be a real blessing to a pastor's managing of himself and God's gift of time. Then we'll go backwards, alphabetical order. We'll give you a chance to start.
I think one of the important things is setting priorities, but setting them biblically. You know, what are God-pleasing priorities? And I remember I used to say that to my people, and finally one president grabbed me and he said, I don't want to hear that word again until you tell me how to do it.
You mean?
Yeah, because we always say it varies for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, there are some principles. For example, our highest priority has to be a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And sometimes in the ministry, that's what's sacrificed.
Mm-hmm.
For example, they'll say, well, I do that in my sermon preparation. I'm not disagreeing that sermon preparation isn't a tremendous benefit. But the end product is really for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Or same like preparing a Bible class. And so I think when they can establish those priorities for themselves and they set their ministry up on the basis of roles and relationships rather than tasks to be completed or people I have to see, that when it's based on roles and relationships, it just makes it a lot happier. I noticed that in the Caribbean, because everybody laughs at the Caribbeans, they have no sense of time. Is it still Tuesday that I'm not late? But when you talk to the Caribbean people, they value relationships higher than time.
Right.
So if I'm talking with you and I need to talk with you longer, it's easier for me to... It works for me to stay and talk to you and ask the other person's forgiveness for being late.
Mm-hmm.
Because relationship is more important than time. And I feel like in the ministry, if we would learn to operate that way, I think we could alleviate a lot of stress.
Because here, so often, time is more important than the relationship.
And I worked in a factory setting that was on incentive pay. And everybody knew the number one mission statement at that factory was time is money. If you went over to talk to somebody, it was just understood he could keep on working and not even give you eye contact, but you could carry on a conversation.
I mean, to quote Covey again, too, but be efficient with things, but your goal is to be effective
with people.
But you can't schedule in 15 minutes blocks.
And I feel that's probably one of the greatest strengths of Covey. I know how to turn my life around, because he's called the fourth dimension of time management. Because it's based on roles and relationship, and it all has to do with people.
Well, as Lutherans, the doctrine of vocation.
Right.
Your calling from God. He would not see it quite from that perspective,
right.
But he would.
Right.
Yeah. Mark, how about you? What tip, insight, benefit would you list?
I don't remember the precise source, but early on somebody told me to find your creative periods. And I found that to be helpful. Now, mine had never changed. I was not by nature an early riser in early ministry. Hagedorn used to call me at 5:30 in the morning because that's when Hagedorn gets up and starts working. It's left over from the goat milking and cow milking days. So he'd check up on me as the new mission planter. How are you doing? What are you doing? I don't do anything well to this day prior to 9 o'clock. And knowing that, though I get up early, I just read, or I will do mundane things. I got a creative period from roughly 9:30 to 11:30. One up middle afternoon and one late at night. It's not supposed to work that way, but some of what I think are probably the most insightful or useful things I did as far as fixing a Bible class or a good application for a sermon came about late at night, maybe after mulling over something all day long. A second thing I guess I would mention would be close to what we were talking about before, but delegating intelligently. And that implies that if you're going to pass off something, you can't simply have a task and say, it's this task and this person has time available. It has to be very much structured around their gifts and capabilities and willingness. For lack of a better term, delegate intelligently.
Mm-hmm. I can take you back to the first one. I think that can be a real burden releaser for many a pastor who thinks everyone has to be Benjamin Franklin. Early to bed and early to rise makes men healthy and wealthy and wise. Yeah. If you're not up at 5:30 functioning at peak performance, you're less of a pastor than someone else. But you have to know Tizaltan, know yourself. And there are many different personality styles and skill sets, even when it comes to managing time.
Yeah. I would agree with that because I'm the opposite. But I have a wife and three daughters, and they all like to get up gradually. My wife said, when you put your feet on the floor, you're at 100 miles an hour. The rest of the world doesn't operate that way. And what I learned then is that I needed to leave the house at that time. Because if you were to ask me at 9 o'clock at 9 p.m., what do you think about this? I said, I don't think about anything after 9 o'clock. I just don't think.
Sure. That's true. I've been with him after 9
o'clock. Now we are getting into confession. Yeah. Here we go.
But my creative juices are probably from 5 a.m. till 9 a.m. Okay. And the other thing for me is exercise is a biggie, and I did my exercise in the morning. But I always did it in such a way that I had a legal pad handy, because then my mind really worked.
Now what we need to do is marry one of your daughters and one of your sons, and they'll be good from like 5 to 11.
Yeah.
Or not good at all. You'll get the... Any other things you've seen, tips, insights that others have shared with you that you've found helpful over the years, that you've seen others profit from that we haven't mentioned?
From a pastoral standpoint, this happened my first pastor's conference that I ever attended, 1977. I roomed with an older pastor. And he said, Ed, what are you going to do tonight as the last day of conference? What are you going to do tonight? And so I got a class I get back for. Just shook his head and he said, you're not going to last long. He said, never schedule anything for the night you come home from conference other than hugging and kissing your wife and playing with your kids. He said, you got to... First of all, you've denied them your presence for 2.5 to 3 days. Said the other thing is you've got to have a time to debrief after you've been in this very special environment. To me, when I go to conference, the rest of the world stops. I was at a conference when the Challenger disaster happened, and it never registered with me.
So
I got back. Oh yeah, did you hear about the Challenger disaster? Oh yeah, it happened 2 days ago.
And those at home need a chance to debrief back
right,
to you.
Right.
Of what's happened in those 2.5
and,
days.
And I never did after that. And guys are saying, I'm just dreading getting home from conference because I got a class tonight. And I said, I can't wait to see my wife and kids. Well, I'm not going to see them until tomorrow. And I, to me, that was just, to me, some of the greatest wisdom sure. that was ever given to me.
Mm-hmm. Very practical tip to use.
Right.
Several times a year. Mark, anything else of things you've seen benefit from Brahms?
Again, going way back, Roger Spring was in Denver when I got there in 83. He would make me go golfing every Tuesday. And I think that's about the time where counseling loads began to increase incrementally. Maybe they had already for other guys, but he said, it's going to be busier for you. And he said, most counseling situations can be addressed and fixed, properly understood, in 3 one-hour sessions. Now, I wouldn't take that out of context, wouldn't make it a universal rule. Some of our people's issues are much deeper than that, profound, and they need more attention. But oftentimes than not, I found him to be true, that if I laid out some time to listen to what the issue was, then thoroughly diagnosed what the issue was a little bit further, and then made some suggestions, and then maybe even said, here's some homework and some things to do, and we'll get back together. 3 one-hour sessions, and if it couldn't be fixed in that time, oftentimes it's not. It was an unwillingness to want fixed. Mm-hmm. So, good tip from a good old guy.
Warrior of the counseling room, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I'll take us to the next one then. The next one is more on the line of a resource or a tool that you found helpful or that you've seen help other brothers. I mean, you haven't used, but you've seen it profit them. If there's a tool that you would mention, a resource you'd mention, and why it's been helpful. Mark, we'll go back to you first.
All I've got, because I've not done nearly as much research and study, and if you have a degree with Covey or something.
Certificate.
Yeah, so this is his niche. But I found Valesky's paper in my files from 1997, and I have made copies and handed that to a guy. And some say, well, I've seen that, or I've got another source. But others say, well, thank you, at least it's something. Mm-hmm. Put my hands and start thinking about how I manage time. And with the sharp guys that come out of this institution, most of them, that's all they need. It's just a simple tool. Get to your place, get the lowdown of it, how you're going to impact community, how you're going to serve these people, and then use a general guideline on managing your time. And they're okay. Mm-hmm. Anything more critical than that, problem children, I send to Ed.
Well, now you sent us there. Tool, resource, and why it's been helpful.
In 1987, I had the opportunity to study at the feet of Dr. Charles Hobbs, who's one of the founders of Daytimer. And it was interesting when I would work with him and we would have to do an industrial consultant with workers. He never once talk to them about their job. He only talked to them about their home life. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you don't have it together at home, you're not going to have it together on the job. And I asked pastors that, do you have it together at home? And that's a challenge sometimes, mm-hmm. that we don't realize that our first congregation as a pastor is really the family altar,
right.
and so forth. The other one would be Dr. Stephen Covey, and I was trained in personal coaching through Covey and so forth. But his seven habits are just awesome. And he's a Mormon, so I'm not, you have to realize that. And for example, he'll talk about the Judeo-Christian tradition, and he's usually quoting Proverbs, which I think is the only book of the Bible he really focuses on. But
he's got a good handle on the law.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, which in the table of duties for one's life can be helpful.
But the thing is I think it's so profound as far as just things that help you in the ministry. For example, one of his seven principles or habits that I really had to learn, little confession here, was seek first to understand before you seek to be understood. And my wife often quotes me and said, how many times haven't you said, but you don't understand what I'm saying? And she said, what would Dr. Covey say? Shut up. You know, and listen to them. Okay, the other one is synergy. How to work with others, and I like to use the reference, does he play? When I was in grade school, we had a thing on the report card that says, plays well with others. And I usually didn't do well. Does he play well with others?
Because you're getting up at 5:30.
Yeah,
right. And just that cooperative spirit.
That cooperative spirit. And I know guys that just have never used anything for really scheduling or anything. I know one fellow, he uses post-it notes on his computer screen. And I said, well, what happens during the summer when it's hot and humid and they fall off? He said, you know, that happens. one fellow, and I encouraged him to read Covey's book with a spirit of discernment. And it's unreal what it's done to his life. I met with him and his wife, and she just can't say enough about it. And what he did was he said, and this is really a Dale Carnegie technique, but he would only read one chapter, and he wouldn't go to the next chapter until he had mastered the first chapter. Mm-hmm. And in Dale Carnegie's book, that's what Dale Carnegie says, you can't go on. If you take a Dale Carnegie course, you can't go to the next level until in class you've demonstrated you understood the first level. Mm-hmm. But he has laid out for himself a weekly schedule, Monday through Sunday. And then he lists all of the roles that he has in life and the relationships equaling each of those roles. And then on Sunday night, which is what I had done, Sunday night he sits down and he says, this is my mission, personal mission statement.
Reviews that. Yeah.
Reviews that. And then you plan the next 7 days. And he finally started doing what I encourage him to do, is run it by your wife.
Is this realistic?
Huh? Yeah, because one time I said to my wife, I have to spend more time with our three daughters. They're growing up and I'm missing out. And so she said, Ed, there's 168 hours in the week, and this week you're giving them 2 hours. And I said, well, I didn't give them any last week, so by rate of improvement, I'm really doing well. But I think when you have somebody there that will help hold you accountable, and he asked me to do that for him, and we talk on a monthly basis, and he sends me all 4 weeks and asks me to review them for him with his own analysis. In fact, he actually types out his personal analysis. As a resource, I just felt the Covey really putting it down based on roles and relationships, because sometimes they talk about you're a task-oriented person or a people-oriented. To me, it was much easier being task-oriented because I didn't have to deal with people. Because people will let you down, tasks
won't. And then you'll be really efficient.
Right, yeah, tremendously, but you're not effective.
Right.
And that's the thing where I think he brought my game up a level. And my people testified to that when I was still in parish ministry. Something happened to him.
Brothers, anything for our brothers that still sticking with you? See, I just wish I had mentioned this. Was there anything else that you... we really wanted to share as we see.
I guess one thing is, and I learned this because I was a chaplain to a secular corporation in the business world. And it's the thing of the 21 squares. And it's 3 a day, 7 days of the week. And they've had efficiency experts, and I just heard another man talk about this, the founder of the company, SAP. Mm-hmm. And they found out that the most efficient, ever-ready bunny kind of person can only handle 15 to 16 squares a week.
Before he loses effectiveness?
Yes. And actually, he'll be able to get things done, but in the industry world, it'll be considered counterproductive because it takes him longer to do it, and it's done with less excellence. So the founder of SAP, I can't say SAP, he hates that. But when I heard him speak last May, he said, this is how much my people work, and no more. And Jim Collins, the author of Good to Great, was interviewing him and challenged him, and he said, well, what about the people at Silicon Valley that are put in 80 to 100 hours a week? Those are really highly efficient people. He said, you know why they put that in? Because that's for all the correction of the mistakes they made after 5 p.m. He said they should have gone home. And it's a thing that, there was a book put out by a Methodist minister that had a nervous breakdown, and it's entitled Clergy Self-Care. And he said that, he feels the pastor's week should be 55 to 60 hours. And he said that's comparable to most of your members in their work schedule, especially since the economic downturn. In Atlanta, when I was pastor there, people left home before 7 a.m. and didn't get home until after 7 p.m. because of the commute. And that's a 12. Now, they aren't getting paid for 12 hours, but that's give you 12 times 5 is 60. Mm-hmm. And so it's not out of line. But the 60 mark is usually where the experts will say inefficiency comes.
Mark, anything else that you wanted to share?
No, those who might kick back at the 60 mark need to understand that our brothers and sisters that work in the secular world, their times are set for them where their 60 hours are going to be. You have a great deal of flexibility given your own personal family, the congregation you serve, the needs that they have. Again, your creative periods, you have a lot of flexibility as to where you're going to plug those 60 hours in a week. And rather than see that as a detriment and waste a lot of time, just sit down with some flexibility, say this is where my 55 hours are going to be.
I often used to note with my wife that I was one of the few dads at an afternoon soccer game.
Correct.
In the grade school, the grade schoolers, and they were playing our schools. I mean, I may be gone many an evening, but I was home for lunch. Yeah. And I could see the kids after school. I needed to and watch a game, even if I was going to be gone that evening when she was helping with homework.
Yeah, I did the transportation for cross country because it's a non-revenue sport.
Sure.
First, because they don't have concessions and all of that. Mm-hmm. But I could transport girls from 3:30 to 6 p.m. Nobody wants you really at that time. Nobody needs you. And when I was in the Navy community of Jacksonville and served as civilian chaplain in the United States Navy, the women loved me because I was the guy that could go and help set the carnival up. Because all their guys were out to sea or flying missions.
Mm-hmm. There's a certain flexibility within being faithful and working hard and getting out. You mentioned the visits and the importance of that. But there's a certain flexibility that we do possess because we do set our schedule. The key is to get to our schedule first and be able to set it.
And that's like I really encourage a lot of men, especially when they have young children or their wife is a stay-at-home mom. I said, just block out 3 to 6 or 4 to 6 every day. No member is going to want you coming over to visit them. They aren't home yet. Right. And or they're going to be preparing supper or whatever. I said, that's 15 hours a week just for your family. And because my wife teaches special education, which is a challenge in and of itself, I gave her 4:15 to 6:15 every evening, Monday through Friday. And first 45 minutes was venting on all that went on in school that day. But it really increased our companionship and our marriage.
Yeah. Well, she knew she could depend on that.
Right. And now with my schedule that I have, when I am home, my wife says I'm really home. Her greatest joy is that I have the garage door up and I'm standing in the garage door waiting for her to get home at 4:20.
Well, brothers, thank you for your time that you gave to your brothers for this interview. And may God bless those who watch it and ponder the encouragement and advice that you gave.
Thank you for the privilege. Thank you for the privilege.